coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Is it wrong to wreck the Earth?
What kind of a person would act recklessly knowing that that might well create the conditions under which the planet wouldn't support human life?
How does the happiness of future generations, those who don't exist yet, affect what's right and wrong now?
We have basic obligations of fairness. These notions that if you make a mess, you clean it up. The notion that if you break something, you own it.
Do we really know that a warmer world is a worse world?
There are cases of invincible ignorance. And to those people, I would say, I don't care.
Is it intrinsically wrong to wreck the Earth?
Our guest is acclaimed environmental ethicist Kathleen Moore.
I mean, we are the recipients of this extraordinary gift. That calls for a response of gratitude from us.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Oregon State University in Corvallis.
Is it wrong to wreck the Earth? Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're recording the program at Oregon State University.
Oregon State University plays an important role in the philosophy world this year because the quarterback of the Oregon State Beavers is a philosophy major, Sean Canfield. Stand up, Sean. Sean is a real Kantian. He treats some people as ends. But our thinking originated at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And we're very pleased to be here in Corvallis. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, folks.
Ken, today's topic is it wrong to wreck the Earth? I suppose the obvious answer is yes.
Well, duh, as my 12-year-old son would say. I mean, so that's, in a way, not an interesting question, but I think the answer may be more obvious than the meaning of the question. I mean, I assume that we're not asking if it's wrong for me or you to wreck the Earth right now for everybody else around, like, you know, you keeping my Earth away from me. But it's something more like what all of us, the people that are currently alive, busily polluting the streams and the rivers and the oceans, warming the globe, killing off species and the like, and having a grand time doing it, and in the process making the Earth a less agreeable place for future generations, are doing something wrong, maybe wrong, to those future generations.
Well, I think you're right. That's the question we're aiming at. But I think it's still pretty clear that the answer is yes, it's wrong. Don't you agree?
Well, look, don't try to back me into being the one who's going to actually advocate wrecking the Earth, John. But is it so obvious that it's wrong? I mean, suppose we frame the question like this. Those currently alive will somehow collectively decide between two options. First, we could make minimal changes to the way we live now and leave future generations a very polluted, very warm Earth. Or we can make very substantial changes to the way we live now, but at great cost to our own comfort level, while leaving a less polluted and less warmed up Earth for future generations. Here's an analogy. Imagine a 70-year-old person. He's got $1 million and a disease that gives him 5 years to live. He has a struggling 40-year-old daughter, too. Now, he can do two things. He can live well for his last 5 years and leave his daughter a small amount, or he can scrimp and save his final 5 years, you know, not enjoying all the things he enjoys, and leave his daughter comfortably well off. I mean, it would be very nice of him to do the latter, but it's not clear to me that it would be wrong for him to do the former.
Well, that's a pretty good analogy, but I think there is a disanalogy buried in the heart of the analogy, like a worm or something.
Okay.
Like that. The man might think that if his daughter works hard, as hard as he has all his life, she could earn enough on her own to be well off. So he may pass up the opportunity to make her life comfortable, which would be nice of him, but he hasn't thereby deprived her of the means of having a nice life herself. But the damage we do to the world, by and large, can't be undone. The parts of the world made uninhabitable by global warming are going to be that way for a long time. The species that disappear will never be brought back into existence. It's one thing for a man not to share the money he has earned and saved with his daughter. It's another for him to destroy the possibility of her doing as well for herself. And that's what we're doing by wrecking the world the way that we are.
Well, you've got a point, but there's another disanalogy. Look, the people who will be most disadvantaged by the damage, let's admit it, we're doing damage to the Earth, the ones who will be, you know, grappling with inundated cities and a non-working Gulf Stream toward the end of this century, they don't exist. They don't exist any more than your imaginary friends exist. I mean, do we really owe anything to people that don't exist? That's a rather puzzling sort of obligation, don't you think?
Well, I guess so. I mean, if the Gulf Stream quits working, Norway will get very, very cold. And so you're asking me, what do we owe to non-existent Norwegians?
There you go.
Well, it's hard to say. But maybe it's wrong to suppose that the wrongness of wrecking the Earth is a matter of mistreating some people or persons that just happen not to exist. I mean, here's another way to look at it. We live in this whole big system, the ecosystem on Earth. It's the system wherein life of every sort has come, including human life. All life has evolved within this ecosystem. Isn't there something intrinsically wrong about harming the system that's the very ground of our existence?
John, John, I never knew you were such a mystical god. I mean, you're an earth worshiper. You worship the earth as if it were a god. But look, what if it turned out that the best thing for the earth and the ecosystem and all the chimps and insects and frogs, what if the best thing for them was that humans would just disappear and quit screwing things up? Would you advocate that out of your earth worship?
I'd have to think about it, but, you know, we're getting a little above my pay grade here. I think we need some help. And we've got Kathleen Dean Moore, a professor right here at Oregon State University, who's going to join us soon. She's just finished co-editing a book called For All Time, Our Obligation to Save the Future. So I guess I know where she stands.
And we want to know where our audience stands, too. We'd like you to join in this conversation.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Rena Palta, talks to someone who tracks the nitty-gritty details of how we're wrecking the Earth. She files this report.
We hear a lot about climate change in the news.
A vast majority of Americans, 85%, now believe global warming is probably happening.
The notion that man-made gas, the CO2, caused global warming is probably the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people.
And the kind of extreme weather scientists warned of 20 years ago.
They've been cooking that science since 1998.
But how much of it is true? What do we actually know about how we're impacting the planet?
You know, there are a lot of changes happening in our environment that may be connected to climate change, but actually proving that connection is pretty difficult.
Philip Moat is director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University.
The problem is that as you zoom in on a locale, its climate is so variable, we can really only discern the influences of greenhouse gases on very large spatial scales.
That being said, Moat believes scientists have made conclusive connections between human actions and earthly consequences. The idea of climate change really took flight after a 1967 study, which modeled the connection between rising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere and rising temperatures. It was a primitive experiment by today's standards.
But nothing really in the last 40 years has overturned the basic conclusion from that paper, which was, no matter how many aspects of the global climate system you either include or ignore, you get the same basic answer. You double carbon dioxide and you're going to increase global temperature by around 5 degrees Fahrenheit.
We've built human societies according to certain understandings of what our climate looks like. Our coastlines, weather patterns, seasons are all things we take for granted when we're building houses, planting crops, and figuring out a city's water supply. Moat says those are the things that will likely change if the world continues warming. Like glaciers melting. Soupy ice cracking holes in roads and other infrastructure. And species like frogs changing their mating patterns and sometimes dying out.
Fish and wildlife changing the timing when different life events happen, expanding or contracting their ranges to follow a warming climate.
Moat says even if we stop all emissions today, carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for some 50 years. And we would be lucky if things leveled off at what's still considered an alarming concentration of greenhouse gases.
Every notch that we fall short of that optimistic goal of only doubling carbon dioxide means additional problems with water supply, agriculture, disease, species extinctions. You know, the ethical question is, how willing are we to make changes in our own comfort level, our own economic strength this year and the next 10 years so that those eventual consequences are not as bad? Science can only go so far in describing the problem. The sort of ethical and philosophical dimension of this is critical.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Rena Palta.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Kathleen Dean Moore. She's a distinguished professor of philosophy here at Oregon State University. She's author of many things. Most recently, she's co-editor with Michael Nelson of the forthcoming For All Time, Our Obligation to Save the Future. Kathleen, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much.
Kathleen, how did you come to focus on philosophical issues involving nature and ecology?
I grew up in Cleveland.
Oh. Where the river burns.
Yes. Where the river burns. And you will remember the Cuyahoga River, so loaded with gasoline and gunk that it does catch fire. And our parents would take us kids down there to watch the fires. Some form of perverse entertainment, I suppose. And I do remember the black clouds over the river and the way that the flames flickered up against them. I also have had the chance to see beautiful, pure, primeval rivers in Alaska, so full of abundance that they didn't seem to have been changed from the very beginning. The bears and the salmon and the cow parsnips and the eagles and so forth, all that beautiful music of flourishing. So when the scientists said, we are facing a choice, we're called to make a choice between two alternative futures, I had very strong visions of these futures in my mind. You know, this is our decade to make that decision.
Well, now, it sounds like you tend to buy everything that Phil Moat and Al Gore say. And I guess I do, too. But in fairness, we ought to point out there's some very distinguished people. I mean, senators from the states that were one of the original 13 colonies. Representatives from places like Minnesota that are very ecologically conscious. People who've risen to the top and have received every honor that talk radio or Fox News has to offer. That are skeptical about this. I guess you're not. How sure are you, and what scenarios do you see as most likely if we don't do anything?
Well, Daniel Quinn, who's the author of Ishmael, tells us to think about it this way. He says, imagine that we live at the top, in a penthouse at the top of a very tall brick tower. And every day we send workers down to the bottom of the structure to pull out a couple of bricks and take them up into the penthouse to make the penthouse bigger, stronger, you know, more hip. Mm-hmm. Well, we can do that for maybe 10 years or 100 years or 500 years. But at some point we will have introduced large channels of emptiness into this structure and that whole edifice will collapse. And our position at the top will not save us.
Well, I take your point. I take your point. But I just want to think about the skepticism that's out there. Rush Limbaugh and the gang say, it's like a threat to capitalism. Environmentalists are anti-capitalist. They're anti-commerce. It's like they think all along we've been, the left has been anti-capitalism, and now they have a new tool. What do you think of that kind of skepticism?
Yeah, I think there's two kinds of skepticism, and I guess we should be clear about which one we're addressing here. There's the kind of skepticism that refuses to accept the data about the fact of global warming. And in that sort of a case, I would agree with you that there are cases of invincible ignorance. But many of the disagreements have to do not with whether there is climate change or whether it is dangerous, but whether it's human caused. Because if it is caused by human beings, then we will have to make some changes in how we live. And to those people, I would say, I don't care. The reason is that we have an option. Either it's caused by humans or it's not. If it is caused by human beings, then of course we should take steps to reduce it. If it's not caused by human beings, it still exists, and it's still dangerous, and we should take steps to reduce it.
So for you, it's overdetermined.
Agreed.
So for you, so whatever the skepticism about the cause of it, it's within our power, and therefore we have a responsibility to try to do what we can. But we'll dig into this more deeply in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis. We're talking about our responsibilities to the Earth with environmental ethicist Kathleen Dean Moore.
Next, we're going to try to figure out what exactly is wrong. What's morally wrong with us wrecking the Earth? Who suffers? And why do we have a moral obligation to do something about it?
How much should we sacrifice to keep the world friendly for future generations? Along with comments and questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from a little corner of paradise called Corvallis, Oregon. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and we're discussing our obligations to the planet and to future generations. Our guest is Kathleen Dean Moore from Oregon State University.
Kathleen, you feel passionately that we have an obligation to keep the Earth and its systems as intact as we can for future generations. But here at Philosophy Talk, we question everything. So what's the source of that duty? Non-existent future generations? Why should we care? The ecosystem itself? The command God gave us to take care of the Earth? What exactly is the source of this obligation?
Well, all of those, all of the above, and certainly more, and gratitude for the great gift of the Earth, and compassion, and an unabashed love for the Earth, and respect for life, and moral integrity, and justice. So maybe we should talk about...
That's a whole lot there. Wait a minute. I want to slow down a bit.
Okay.
I want to slow down, because I get puzzled about the idea that we owe future generations anything, because since they don't exist, how can we? And I get puzzled about the, I mean, you think, and many people think, we have a moral obligation. But we can't have an obligation to the Earth. It's not the subject of moral obligations. It's not like a moral partner. So why is it even a moral issue as opposed to just a practical, prudential kind of thing? Why is there a moral dimension to this at all?
Well, let's take all those questions kind of separately. The first question you asked me had to do with how can we have an obligation to non-existent beings?
Right.
And I think that we have obligations all the time to abstractions. We honor our obligations to the future. Oftentimes, let me cite Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream. It was I Have a Dream for the future. It was I Have a Dream for all those children. Let me cite people who fight and die for the abstraction of democracy, even though it doesn't exist.
Okay, wait a minute. Let's slow down. Okay, I can have obligations to you, say, because we're in some kind of relationship, right? What relationship am I in to the future non-existent beings such that, I mean, do I owe it to them? I mean, because they're not there, so am I in a moral relationship with them?
Yes, you are, because you're damaging them by the decisions that you're making now. We have basic obligations of fairness. These notions that if you make a mess, you clean it up. The notion that if you break something, you own it. In the example that you gave earlier where you're talking about the man who was worried about whether he should give money to his daughter,
right.
The disanalogy is that in this case, the man is actively harming his daughter's chances for happiness. And it's that active harm that he does that obligates him to provide her with the ability at least to seek well-being.
Yes, our primary picture of an obligation might be an obligation to another person. We agree to come to Corvallis, and if I'd gotten here and you didn't come, you would have broken your obligation
right,
to me
right.
and to all of
right.
you. But in fact, we freely talk about lots of other kinds of obligations around a university, and particularly in philosophy departments. You hear all kinds of talk about love of truth, obligations of truth, the value of truth. Well, what's truth? The truth is pretty darn abstract. And then also, whenever you care about something, as a matter of fact, I heard an interesting talk about it at noon today by you. how our own valuing and caring and being concerned and things mattering to us does create obligations. Since most of us do plan, if not to spawn ourselves, at least to allow and appreciate the results of other doing so, there will be future generations.
Right, right. But let's go back to the idea that we could harm a non-existent being. See, okay, I can harm you by making you worse off at some future time than you are now, right? Now, I can harm the future generations how? I mean, they're not here. So they don't have a state of well-being, and so I'm not diminishing their well-being. Now, I'm not trying to say we should wreck the Earth. I'm just trying to understand, in virtue of what, there's a moral dimension in terms of justice or obligation or right and wrong to this question. I'm trying to understand the source of it as a moral dimension.
Well, Kathleen loads up the heavy artillery. Let me just note that. I mean, take our offices at Stanford, right? Our offices at Stanford are terrible, right? Because somebody a long time ago took a wonderful 18-foot rooms and put a ceiling in at 8 feet so that we could have 2 stories worth of crummy offices instead of 1 story
That's
worth
right.
of elegant offices.
And if you're on the second floor, the windows are at your feet.
Yeah, because, yeah. Now, when I sit in my crummy 8-foot office, I'm irritated with the people that made that decision, right? I feel they harmed me. Even if I hadn't been born at the time they made that decision, which I probably was, unfortunately. But, still, I mean, I was just an abstraction to them, but the harm they did to me is real. Future generations will blame us, and they'll be right to do so. Doesn't it follow that we must owe them something?
What do you think, Kathy?
Well, I certainly agree with John. There are difficulties, I acknowledge, with the notion of trying to understand in the usual terms of discussing obligations, which generally are person to person. But if you create the conditions under which it's impossible for people to thrive, then at the point when they're seeking a decent life, then they have become harmed.
Right, right. So I want to just let's ask you to follow up on John's thought. Because I wonder, so if we were to keep going the way we're going, and the future, and we lasted long enough to be around when the future generations had to pay these costs, I do take your point that if the guys who divided the building that way were around now, I'd say, what the hell were you doing? What the hell were you doing? But is that more than my expressing my displeasure at what they did? I mean, can I really say they violated my right to a high office, you know, with sweeping ceilings? Can I really say they violated a right of mine?
I wouldn't use the language of rights, because I think that that is trapped in the old way of thinking about human beings as individual and as the locus of value. And I think we have to start thinking a little bit differently about people as part of community. So I wouldn't invoke the notion of rights. I think at this point I might think a little bit about integrity. And it may be that the question that we should ask is not so much what should I do, but who should I be? And maybe what we're thinking now is about what kind, not have we done harm, but what kind of a person would act recklessly knowing that that might well create the conditions under which the planet wouldn't support human life.
That's an interesting thought. And I'll remind our audience, this is philosophy talk. We're talking about, is it wrong and why is it wrong to wreck the Earth? We're here at Oregon State University in Corvallis, and we'd love to have questions from our live audience. And we've got a questioner on this side of the auditorium now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you.
Tell us your name and then give us your comment or question.
My name's Joe Magner. And my question concerns, we've been talking about human beings and what we owe human beings, but we're really part of the overall Earth itself. And do we owe anything to the other creatures and the potential for them?
That's a good question. John is a Earth worshiper, right? I mean, you really are. And you say
absolutely.
I think you think the Earth itself kind of deserves a kind of respect and reverence from us. Do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, we oftentimes talk in terms of the instrumental value of the Earth, its uses for us, the ecosystem services. But I also would say that the Earth and all the species that you were mentioning have an intrinsic value as well. And when I say that, people oftentimes go, well, what could that possibly mean? That's so abstract, I can't figure it out. So what I ask them is to think of this thought experiment. If you were the last person on Earth, as all of us were bailing out, and you were stepping onto the steps of the rocket ship that was going to take you away, in other words, if the Earth was going to have no use for human purposes whatsoever, would it be wrong for you to light the fuse that would destroy every species left on the planet?
Well,
if you think that it is wrong, then you in some way honor the intrinsic value or the value of the diversity of life beyond its usefulness for human purposes.
Well, but wait a minute. I would not destroy paintings. I think they're beautiful things. I would not just take anything of beauty. But I don't think I'm obligated to the painting. But I don't owe it to the painting not to destroy it.
But you probably have negative obligations towards other people and who value it. But I wonder if you don't have a negative obligation to the at least to the values of the painting or the beauty of the painting.
Let me take this a little bit different direction. Now, you mentioned Daniel Quinn. His prescription, or at least Ishmael's, the ape in his book, is very radical. You know, we went off the rails with Cain and Abel. We shouldn't have started agriculture. We should have stuck with hunting and gathering. I suspect your prescription is not that radical. But it sounded like it might be pretty radical. You're talking about individualism. That's a pretty solid American philosophical value. How much of the way we look at the world, what we value in the world, the basic philosophical views we have about rights and individuals, how much will we have to give up to really change things in the way you think they need to be changed?
There are people who argue that we will not make progress on climate change and environmental degradation until we have a sea change in our worldview. And we have been thinking for so many centuries that we are the center of the universe, that the universe was created for us, that we are essentially individual, and that we find our true being in the competition among essentially people of equal strength. But ecologists and almost all the religions of the world are telling us quite a different story about ourselves, that we are part of interdependent network of intricately organized parts, and that our fullness of human being is a matter of strengthening and making those interrelationships flourish. So it may well be that until we can get over ourselves and the notion that we might be kings of the universe and understand ourselves as part of a network, that we can't make the steps that we need to solve these problems.
We've got more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, Devin Monahan, longtime listener, first time more than listener. my biggest question is, does Earth have the systems to kind of balance out humanity's effects, you know, in spite of our best efforts?
That would be so good.
Well,
honestly,
I think the problem is that geologic time is slow. I mean, the dinosaurs were wiped out in an instant, but now the Earth teems with new life forms. But you know, it took a long time. So the human time scale is small. Geologic time scale is large. So maybe over millennia, and you know, but we don't want to wait that long. But we've got more questions on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. Tell us your name and your question.
My name is John Dorbolo, Oregon State University. If we're going to frame this issue in moral terms, invoking rights, obligations, and all of the aspects of that, in many of the issues that involve the rights of others, at some point, force is enabled in order to create the remedies and the prevention that's necessary to prevent the harm to the other. And so I'm wondering, in this kind of case, and I think this is one of the sources of the skepticism that we hear, at what point, or is there a point at which we envision force being used in order to create the conditions and prevent the harms?
I think that's a very good question. Thank you for that question. I mean, there's a kind of liberty. I mean, exercising human liberty, capitalism and all that, has polluted the earth. Right? To undo that, some people fear, I think, that we have to radically curtail human liberties. What do you think?
Well, just to kind of put it in concrete terms, in America, people have been very critical of the Chinese for limiting the size of families and saying that it violates basic human rights and so forth and so on. At the same time, it seems like that's the sort of thing that will have to be done to make any big changes. So there does seem to be a fundamental issue there. But now I'll turn it over to you.
Well, we are trying to avoid the use of force, obviously, by making this a market issue and the cap-and-trade strategies, which I am deeply suspicious of. I don't believe in force at all, but I also don't believe in marketing and selling the right to pollute or the right to injure children's health. I think that's an appalling solution.
I think we've got time for one last question before the break.
I'm Jonathan Zaworski. I'm a mechanical engineering student here, so I will not pretend to be a philosopher in any way, shape, or form. But I have to wonder, the name of this discussion is it wrong to wreck the Earth? Which seems to be making the assumption that climate change is inherently a bad thing, which I have to wonder about, because if you'll forgive the hijacking of your metaphor, you were talking about your office earlier, and now you have, instead of a beautiful 18-foot ceiling, you have crummy little 8-foot ceiling. But my question is it possible that in doing that, it allowed them to give offices for another set of people, which is better for the department as a whole, even if it's worse for you personally? So is change in the environment, changing in the climate, bad for the world as a whole, or are we just being arrogant in assuming that it is?
Well, that's a very good question. My sense is that we're being a little unarrogant in the sense that it probably won't be so bad for us or for you here in Oregon as it will be for people a long ways away in Africa. But I don't know. Maybe Kathleen knows.
I don't know either. But we are living in a very finely evolved and intricately interconnected, tightly balanced system. And to introduce change into that system in a reckless manner seems to me to invite disaster. So I hope that you're right, that maybe the benefits would outweigh the costs. I'm not optimistic.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking whether it's wrong to wreck the Earth, and if so, why. Our guest is Kathleen Dean Moore from Oregon State University.
In our next segment, we'll get practical. What should we really do that in a realistic way could fulfill our obligations to the Earth and to future generations?
We're coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis. We'll take more questions and comments from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're asking whether it's wrong to wreck the Earth.
Our guest is Kathleen Moore, co-editor of the forthcoming For All Time, Our Obligation to Save the Future.
We've got lots of questions from our live audience here, so we'll go to this side of the room.
Thank you. Del Alexander from Albany, an OSU graduate. I'd like to go back to your example of the painting. Nothing was said about the painter, the person who created this wonderful work of art. Assume for a moment that we accept the notion that God or some creator created all the animals, all the plants. Do we have some ethical obligation to them, as we would maybe to consider the ethical obligation to protect this wonderful work of art created by the painter?
Well, God also created Jupiter, which is a swamp of methane gas, you know, and Pluto, which is a rock of ice.
And South Carolina.
Yeah. And would he be particularly upset if the Earth turned into a swamp of methane gas? He might say, well, another swamp of methane gas. If we think we're the center of his attention and that the Earth is the center of his attention and he says preserve it, then yes. But if he's just an indifferent observer of all the possibilities, then I don't know. Kathleen, you're shaking
your head. Well, look at it a different way. I mean, we are the recipients of this extraordinary gift. We didn't earn it. We don't particularly deserve it. If it's taken away from us, there's nothing we could do to get it back. That calls for a response of gratitude from us. And how do you exercise gratitude but to honor the gift? So yes, I would say that in response to this divine creation, we have a duty to care for, honor, rather than just disregard and destroy
look,
what's been given.
I love the Earth, and I agree. And I agree that we should treat it well. But I don't know that it comes from anything except the random fluctuation of quantum nature. And so a gift of, I mean, we're a gift of quantum nature, I guess, maybe. But so I don't think that its origin is a source of obligations.
But I mean, we've got this range of human attitudes. And it's amazing. We have this attitude of worship. There's one of our heroes, Bertrand Russell, wrote an essay called A Freeman's Worship. And the point was, you should worship numbers, right? And Plato thought you should worship numbers and other forms, like the form of identity, right? Now, if we don't laugh at them, then how much more sensible is it
to worship,
to worship something that is really the source of every good emotion and nice experience that any sentient organism has ever had?
That is so
worship the earth.
So to respect and have awe and reverence for the earth is to have respect and awe and reverence for the ground of our being as the possibility. But we don't have to think of it as from any source except nature. I mean, we don't have to think of the divine commandment to have awe and reverence to the earth.
Mother nature, personified.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get some more questions. Our first a female voice in this discussion from the audience.
My name is Shannon, and I'm a geography major here at Oregon State. And my question is sort of, it has to do with a lot of the things that you were talking about here. It seems like what I'm taking away mostly is that we're so lost in the metaphors and the analogies that we've forgotten what is really going on here. And that's that our soul survival depends on this being called the earth. Our soul life is wrapped around it. And our moral obligation to save it, that should be our sole purpose of this whole journey and life path that we take. And it's like we're so confused by all the things that we've created from the earth that we're forgetting this main thing. So I think that we're kind of moving in the right track here as, you know, what are we doing and where are we going and what is the next step to make this more a cohesive place where we can worship and enjoy everything around us.
So Shannon, let's throw it right back to you, though. What are the steps we should take? To get rid of capitalism?
You know what?
Get rid of individualism? What do you want to do?
I really think that it's more than just me taking my cloth bags to the grocery store and me trying to ride my bike to work. It's like got to be from the top down as well as from the bottom up. It's got to be the government saying we need more transportation, we need better ways to get around, and people, the community, people just saying, hey, we want change. It's about the power of your dollar bill. You know, where you spend your money actually matters. You don't want to support people who are, you know, supplying slave labor. You want to support the people that are for the things that you care about.
Those are really well taken points. Those are extremely well-taken points, and they lead to something that we've sort of talked about in passing, but I actually want us to think about what will it take to pull this thing off. And I especially want to think about it in terms of is the global undertaking. And, you know, we in the United States are the winners from the capitalist degradation of the earth, and the people in the third world have lost. And now if we're going to say we're going to radically change the way we do things, considerations of justice are tricky and complicated. It's not really just a matter of us all adopting a worshipful attitude, because that doesn't tell us where the rubber meets the road. Who has to give up what in order to bring this thing about? Who has to give up what, in your view?
Yeah, so we do need to recycle, and we do need to change those sorts of things, but we can't let that distract us from the main point, and that is that the problem lies in these huge global extractive industries and the government that is in thrall to them and this ideology of constant growth. So our real work, I mean, if we put it baldly, our work is to take away the ability of the powerful to destroy the world. And
let me push back there a little bit. Because that's my job as host.
He's a powerful guy.
That's my job as host. So take away the ability of the powerful, that's the corporations and the governments, the military-industrial complex. But, you know, the consumption in the world is not driven by those big top-down guys. It's driven by us. You know, we want the bigger houses, the bigger pools, the bigger cars. And moreover, we're at a stage in history where the third world, the developing world, they want in on that consumption. So you're not just saying to the big, powerful corporations. You're saying to the whole human species, rebalance your consumption. And you're saying it at a time when we consume all this stuff and all those people who want to get on in the game. It's coming at a very bad time for people in the third world, isn't it?
Well, what I think it calls for among all us relatively privileged, relatively guilt-ridden people is conscientious objection. I mean, we remember this from the Vietnam War. It's the refusal to allow powerful institutions to make us instruments of death and destruction. So if it appalls you that there's 10 times more plastic in the ocean than phytoplankton, then you shouldn't buy plastic. And if you think that wars for oil are a moral abomination, then don't burn fossil fuels. I mean, this is what it's going to have to take for us at least to have the moral authority to make these kind of
changes. But it's not easy. In order to come up here and facilitate your making this point, we encouraged Southwest Airlines to burn a bunch of fossil fuels. Let me ask you, it seems to me there is one missing element is intellectual, and that is economists haven't really given us a model for prosperity in a shrinking gross national product. I mean, if the population gets smaller, we wouldn't have to give up so much apiece. Even if we knew how to make the population smaller, though, economists would say, "Well, we don't know how to keep prosperity going in a shrinking population." But there must be an answer to that. So there is some hard intellectual work to be done here, not just by climate scientists, but by basic thinkers.
But here's a fear that some people have. I think inchoate as the right is sometimes on these issues, they really see something, that this thing to be addressed is a challenge to fundamental things that have been the basis of our prosperity, whether it's a morally acceptable prosperity or not, capitalism and economic growth and the things that make for economic growth. And they see all that going away and replaced by they don't know what, right? They think socialism's government control, the absence of liberty. And I don't know, it sounds like there may be some basis for that worry. I mean, not that it's enough to justify inaction, but it may be that such sweeping change has to happen that we really don't know what our social life will be like in order to deal adequately with this. Is that right or wrong?
Oh, I think I would grant your point. When human beings try to get together to assure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, it's governments that we form. And what we're looking for collective action is an effective government that can do this collectively, that what we can't do individually. So you're making a good point,
Do you think we need a world government? I mean, this is a worldwide problem. Do you think that global institutions are adequate to deal with? I mean, the Chinese are going pell-mell. Mm-hmm. They want in on Western consumption, right? They've been producing all this stuff. Now they want to consume and consume and consume. And they will apparently put more greenhouse gases at the rate they're going in a decade than we have over our entire economic history. Our nation's just going to stand up and say, oh, I'll sacrifice. My people will sacrifice. What's going to happen here?
Yeah. If we think of the carbon sink or the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb carbon as kind of a commons, people are going to be wanting to take it from the commons. But I think that we don't necessarily need a world government, but we do need the ability to put sanctions on governments that aren't cooperating. For example, I think the United States should be under economic sanctions for not having ratified the Kyoto Treaty.
Yeah. One thing we might start thinking about doing is when these millions of people have to leave the places where they live because of global warming, nations should accept them, perhaps in proportion to the extent that they've contributed to global warming.
There you go.
Well, that means there'll be a lot of people in California.
And South Carolina.
Yeah. So, Kathleen, I'm going to give you a chance to have whatever closing thoughts you'd like to share with us.
Well, I do think it's time for us to think, and not in terms of the consequences. You know, my students are in despair over this kind of an issue, and it's really hard to know what to say to them, except to quote Frederick Buechner, who said, your calling is a place where your great joy meets the world's great need. And that's what I would want to conclude with, is that this isn't all a matter of desperation. This is a matter of finding what you truly care about and then devoting your life to its protection.
Well, on that uplifting note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Inviting us to your house. All Our guest has been Kathleen Dean Moore. She's a distinguished professor of philosophy here at Oregon State University, a wonderful writer. I was reading some of her stuff, and it's just beautiful prose. Author of many things, most recently co-editor with Michael Nelson of the forthcoming For All Time, Our Obligation to Save the Future.
We also want to thank everyone here in Corvallis for participating in our program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
Okay, John, so you've got any final thoughts?
I mean, I share a little bit of the pessimism of Kathleen's students, right? It's like you're trying to make a plane and you're late for the plane, and somebody says, well, you know, they're often late anyway. And that's a comforting thought. So in a way, I find the right wing very comforting. Maybe they're right. The science isn't right. Global warming won't be so bad and so forth and so on. I mean, I hope they're right, but unfortunately, I don't believe they're right.
No.
I'm not sure we can do much. It may not be a matter of knowing what to do, but being able to do it. I'm reminded of that movie On the Beach where they know the world is coming to an end, and they have to figure out what to do with their last moments. And that's kind of sad.
Look, I think we are always shirking hard decisions, but now the moment is upon us, and we have to rethink human life. We have to rethink social organization. We have to rethink economies. And it's a good time to be a philosopher, because that's what we do, rethink human possibilities and human configuration. So, you know, in a way, I'm glad that we were at such a moment.
Little Kenny Sunshine.
Well, on that note, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. And also, if you're a Facebookie, we have an ever-growing Facebook page. We've got 2,500 Facebook fans, and if you spend your time on Facebook, waste some time on the Philosophy Talk page as well.
You can also download podcasts of our program from our website. For the final word, we turn to the ecological speed trap, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, whenever I hear talk about obligation to the future, it makes me nervous. The Third Reich was supposed to host a glorious future that would last 1,000 years. Instead, it flamed out in 6, taking millions of people along with it. I have a hunch that this, along with the failed Marxist future and recent alarms about capitalism, have a lot to do with the resistance of doing something about global warming, say, or any of the other numberless ills that plague the present. Dreaming a lot of better futures often led to a world much worse. And then there are the Jonestown suicides, the suicide by cop of the Branch Davidians, the homicidal kids at Columbine, the Heaven's Gate suicides. All were infected by the belief that there is no future at all. And there are those who believe that the future will come to a screeching halt, and soon. The rapture, the Antichrist, the return of Satan, the return of Jesus, the final battle, the end with 1,000 exclamation points. Those who believe that the rapture is coming feel an obligation to the future, yes, but only that future which contains the bullet points of prophecy, which is why so many born-agains are avid supporters of Israel. One of the bullet points of the end times is that Israel must remain intact. That's so the forces of the Antichrist can wipe out 2/3 of Israel just before Armageddon destroys the world. I don't see what Israel gets out of this timetable, but I guess it's grateful for all the support it can muster right now. So, true believers are just hanging on until the rapture comes, which will be any minute now. Though there are some disagreements about what the rapture entails, some say that all the faithful will be taken up bodily into the air, and that's that. Others say that when the faithful are taken in the air, Jesus will come to meet them halfway, and later on, after fire, pestilence, war, starvation, and so forth, they'll all come back to earth together to gloat in the ruins. And who gets taken? Only those who accept Christ as their personal savior. Good deeds don't count. You could be a serial killer, but if you accept Jesus, you're in. What about children? Well, some will be raptured, some not, depending on how young they are and whether their parents are believers or not. What about pets? Sorry. Believers should probably make arrangements for pet care with their atheist neighbors before they go. Tim LaHaye, co-author of the Left Behind books, posits that around 50% of Americans will be raptured. Well, that seems like wishful thinking to me. And what if you qualify but don't want to be raptured just yet? Maybe you're in a new relationship or you landed your dream job. Can you hang on to a lamppost until the tug of the rapture goes away? Also, what happens to the clothing of the rapture? According to the movies I've seen, and yes, I have seen several movies about the rapture, the raptured's clothing are left behind in neat little folded piles. I don't know if there's celestial dry cleaning involved here or not, but again, who gets those clothes? And all the other possessions left behind by the rapture, depending on how many actually get taken, the world might see one hell of a yard sale.